This is Marketplace Money for the week of February 12th, 2010. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, supporting financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide since 1937. Putnam, a world of investing.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is Marketplace Money. Better than last month, but worse than last year. That is the latest word on foreclosure rates from RealtyTrack. There were fewer foreclosures in January than in December, but they were still far higher than the same time last year. And the company estimates as many as 3.5 million more are on the way. Many homeowners are tempted to walk away or sell the house for less than they owe and just be done with it. But as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports, that debt could haunt you for years to come.
In Fort Collins, Colorado, retired Navy Lieutenant Commander James Poole is going through his second foreclosure, this time as a renter.
The house has been sold in foreclosure, and we are waiting for the bank to tell us when they want us to leave.
Poole lost his own home to foreclosure years earlier. When the auction didn't cover the amount owed on the mortgage, the lender came after him for the difference. That's what's known as the deficiency, in his case about $40,000. He says it ruined his credit and discouraged future lenders.
The lender will look into that and he'll see this big deficiency judgment of tens of thousands of dollars on the record and decide maybe they don't want to take second place behind that big a judgment.
Some people get caught by surprise. They assume that by giving up the title to the property, they will be released from their financial responsibilities. Donya Monroe is executive director of the nonprofit Neighborhood Housing Services of Southern Nevada.
Unequivocally, absolutely not. It does not automatically release you from your deficiency or your obligation to pay that loan.
Some borrowers try a short sale. That's where, before the property goes into foreclosure, it's sold for less than is owed on the loan. Again, lenders won't necessarily let you off the hook. Bob Jacobs is a California real estate lawyer.
I've had more than one client come in my office after they had completed a short sale and received a letter from a collection agency.
Laws differ from state to state. About 20 states have what are known as non-recourse loans. They protect the borrower so the bank can't seize your assets if you default. In other states, borrowers are more vulnerable. Frank Alexander is a professor at Emory Law School.
When you walk away from a debt, you should assume that you're putting at risk not only your current assets, but also your future earnings and your reserves for retirement.
So, how do you protect yourself?
The way to make sure there is no deficiency action is to have the lender provide a copy or the original of the promissory note marked paid in full. Alternatively, the lender can simply provide written documentation of satisfaction of the debt.
Housing advocate Donya Monroe says lenders may not forgive the entire outstanding balance of, say, $50,000.
You may be able to negotiate a settlement of that $50,000. You may be able to negotiate some sort of terms into paying back a reduced amount.
All the experts recommend consulting an attorney. Even then, you may still be forced to take desperate measures. Again, James Poole.
It may be that you need to file bankruptcy at some point to get rid of the deficiency judgment.
That's what Poole did in order to get out from under the $40,000 deficiency judgment hanging over him. Now he's financially stable, but his housing is still tenuous. Even though it's his landlord who is in foreclosure this time around, Poole and his wife still have to move. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace Money.
Who knows when, if, we'll ever have health care reform? Meanwhile, millions of people looking for coverage are turning to something known as discount health plans. They're available in all 50 states, and they promise affordable health care coverage. But many times, those promises aren't worth the paper they're printed on. It's becoming a big issue here in California. Some 6 million people have bought the discount plans. And here's a clue as to where the problem lies. We called the California Insurance Commissioner's office, and they told us they have no oversight because this is not insurance. So, Cindy Enos joins us. She's the director of the California Department of Managed Health Care. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Tess.
What are these discount health plans, and how are they being confused with insurance?
Well, a discount health plan promises deep discounts from doctors, hospitals, and pharmacies. But when an individual tries to use the discount card, they learn that the provider to whom they are referred never heard of the discount plan, has no agreement with them to offer discount prices, or would offer the same or a better discount to any cash-paying patient. And so here's an individual who has been paying up to hundreds of dollars a month for something that they believed had inherent value and often are represented to believe that it is in fact insurance.
How big is this problem? Is it affecting a lot of people?
Well, again, we have no reason to believe that California is unique in having approximately 150 companies currently doing business in the state of California, and many of which we believe are operating in a less than fair fashion. And we have no reason to believe that it isn't as big a problem nationally. We know that we are one of approximately 21 states that are moving to take steps to rein in this fraudulent activity.
What is the legitimate use of these plans?
Well, a legitimate use would be a discount that, in fact, does correspond perhaps to a particular clinic, to a particular hospital or pharmacy that is deeper than the discount that would be offered to any uninsured cash-paying patient off the street. Someone who is insured in general is not going to require that discount health card.
So what can your office do to crack down on these plans?
Well, what we have been doing is issuing cease and desist orders to currently 17 fraudulent discount health card companies. And we have said, look, you come in and you at least show us that you are not a fraudulent company, and we will allow you to continue to do business. That has allowed us to then clean up the activity of a large number of the players out there that we, again, assumed were the worst behaved.
What are the red flags for people to watch for if they're considering buying one of these memberships?
Well, first of all, if something comes over in the form of a blast fax to a business, that is a high red flag. That is, in fact, one of the main marketing mechanisms that is used. If, in fact, someone is on the phone and is being told that this is insurance and the rate for that product is up to $150 a month, that should be a red flag that, in fact, there's some additional questions that need to be asked.
Cindy Enos is the director of the California Department of Managed Healthcare. Thanks for walking us through this.
Thank you, Tess.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. If you shop at warehouse clubs like Costco or Sam's Club, I'm sure this will sound all too familiar. You go in expecting to spend, $100 on laundry detergent, toilet paper, all the other things you really need. You end up spending at least twice that to take home a 10-pack of linguine and a 5-gallon jug of Patron Silver. This, dear listener, prompts us to wonder.
Let me start with question number one. What the hell were you thinking?
Yes, what were you thinking? Our look at why we do what we do with our money. We sent Rachel Dornhelm to her local big box store to find out.
It's the middle of the afternoon, but the parking lot at my local Costco is packed. After finding a spot, I grab a shopping cart the size of a small car and head into the cavernous space, past the person checking membership cards, and then through a canyon of tempting electronics.
Okay, so now I've walked in, made it past the big screen TVs. I'm kind of in this center of the store where there are kites hanging and flags and tables of clothes.
I stop and pull my list out, fully intending to focus on just that.
The oats, the hummus, toilet paper, yogurt,
I am not going to fall into the trap of spending money to save money on things I don't need. But there are queues all around me screaming great deals, huge discounts. Larry Compote studies consumer behavior at Clarkson University. He says that inner voice chimes in as soon as you lay your hands on that giant cart.
Immediately as they walk in and they experience the scale, they start thinking value, saving money, lower prices.
And that membership card you have to flash as you enter, that whole gatekeeper aspect of the place, that also activates my bargain antenna, says Compo.
If you have to pay $50 a year just to shop there to get the member prices, then they must be good prices. They must be low prices.
Which is probably how oodles of kids' clothes and stacks of books from the first tables I encountered immediately end up in my cart.
Here's my problem. If I see books on a table, I just have to look.
But this isn't all about the virtues of reading. I'm likely feeling something else, too, a feeling of urgency.
The inference that most consumers are going to make is that this must be something temporary. Either these are items that are on sale, these are items that are going to be discontinued. There's something special about these, otherwise they wouldn't be out on the table somewhere.
And then there are only 316 shopping days until Christmas. Herb Sorensen, who studies consumer behavior, says shopping is way more emotional than rational.
Price doesn't drive shopping as much as it's thought to. However, perceived pricing does.
Who knew a forklift had anything to do with that? My ears hear it as forklift coming through, but my brain registers it as warehouse, wholesale prices. Retail designers say every sense is considered in a store's design, so there are visual cues. Some are obvious, like the plain steel shelves holding cases of canned corn and gallon jugs of salsa. And then there's the lighting.
Warehouse store lighting is generally as little lighting as possible with as much wattage as possible.
That's Barbara Bester, chair of graduate studies at the Woodbury School of Architecture in Los Angeles. Bester says the bargain warehouse design probably grew out of pure function, but it's become its own aesthetic. Bester points to the way warehouses display large quantities of the same thing over and over again, like cereal.
You know, like a regular supermarket even has one of each cereal box facing you and a whole stack of them behind, and here you have like an entire wall of Honey Nut Cheerios.
Bester says this overabundance encourages buying by sending the message everybody else is stocking up, so I probably should too. Maybe that's what I was thinking when I rolled up to the warehouse dairy case tiled with big pink tubs that were only $4.99.
I should be able to eat 3 pounds of cottage cheese in 3 weeks, maybe.
But what if I stumbled across this same deal at my local supermarket? Who knows? But it's definitely something to think about over my next bowl of cottage cheese. I'm Rachel Dornhelm for Marketplace Money.
You'll often hear annuities described as a no-no, but now they're looking more alluring.
I don't know if they'll ever be sexy, but, you know, the president and his crew were talking them up and, you know, they're on the radar screen again.
That's next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. You'd think being commander-in-chief would be title enough for the president of the United States, but no. Turns out this one may add financial planner-in-chief to his bona fides. The Obama administration's middle class task force issued a report recently that suggested annuities as a great retirement tool. That recommendation made insurance companies happier than a tween at a Justin Bieber concert. But for those of you still scratching your head over both annuities and that reference, we've got Ron Lieber with us. He writes the Your Money column for the New York Times. Ron, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So you're going to help us bring sexy back to annuities, right?
I don't know if they'll ever be sexy, but, you know, the president and his crew were talking them up and, you know, they're on the radar screen again.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm just guessing here, but I do think that annuities are probably one of those things that people have heard of but don't really understand. Give us a quick and dirty on what they are, and then we'll get to the pros and cons.
Sure. Well, in their simplest form, annuities allow you to turn over a chunk of income and in return get a stream of income, often for the rest of your life. Simple as that, at least in their simplest form. But the way they got complicated is that, you know, sort of simple immediate annuity that I described before has morphed into variable annuities and other forms of annuities that might be tied to stocks or bonds or mutual funds or a particular stock index. Those types of annuities, the variable ones in particular, have become known for high fees, high commissions. That's where consumers sort of get into danger territory. But that's not really what the Obama administration has in mind, I don't think. What they're trying to solve for is the problem of people potentially running out of money during the decumulation period, right? You retire, you've accumulated a bunch of money. Now you're going to spend it over what you think will be the rest of your life. The problem is that, you know, many Americans are not suited to setting up a plan for themselves to kind of parcel out that money in little bits. And what the annuity can do for them, you know, if they turn over a third of the lump sum they have at retirement or half or something like that, then they can get a regular paycheck for life that will help ensure that they will never run out of money for their most basic of needs.
So then that would be the upside. The downside, presumably, is that if, God forbid, you die sooner rather than later, you're leaving money on the table. It's just gone.
I mean, there are all sorts of downsides, Tess. I mean, what you name is the first one. Again, in its simplest form of annuity contract, yes, when you die, the money's gone. And so if you buy the annuity at 65 and you die at 68, well, the insurance companies come out ahead. There are ways around that. I mean, you can pay a little extra or get a little less each month so that the annuity will last 20 years regardless of whether you die or not. And so the rest of the money might go to your spouse or it might go to your heirs. And the insurance company has come up with all sorts of ways around lifespan and how long you might live. Where it starts to get tricky, though, is, you know, one of the arguments that people make was that, you know, I can do better. I can get a better payout if I just, you know, create an investment scheme for myself and you know, pay myself 5% of my lump sum each year. Most of these circumstances, the money won't disappear, you know, unless some sort of catastrophic once-in-a-generation market event occurs, right?
Which never happens.
Which never happens, right? We haven't seen anything like that recently. But there's a risk that you actually aren't capable of setting this up for yourself in the first place. If you hire someone to do it for you, that will cost money. If you are lacking in discipline, you may spend more than you are supposed to, and you will run down your assets sooner. So, you know, there are all sorts of ways that that can, you know, potentially cause problems if you're trying to handle it yourself.
And I know one other thing that you need to watch out for, Ron, is that there are limits on being able to insure this money, right? Say the company that sold the annuity to you goes out of business.
Right. In the same way that you only want to put a certain amount of money in a bank account so that the FDIC will insure it in case the bank goes belly up, the same thing is true with these annuity contracts. The problem is that they're all overseen by different what are called guarantee funds in all 50 states. And so you've got to see what your state guarantees. Could be as little as $100,000 per annuity or $100,000 total per individual. Could be as much as $500,000 or so.
You know, you pointed out in your story that even the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, warns against some kinds of annuities. How do you know which ones are good and which ones to run away from?
A good rule of thumb is that, you know, if somebody's trying to sell it to you 10 or 20 years before you retire, there's a pretty good chance that there are, you know, high fees involved with that and some amount of risk. Now, when you're retiring, though, I mean, what you want to ask, you know, is this going to guarantee me a set payout for life that doesn't depend on how the stock market does and it doesn't depend on how the bond market does? Even if somebody's trying to sell you a simple annuity, if they're suggesting that you should put all of your money in it, that's almost always a bad idea. I mean, you want to be diversified, in retirement as well.
Do you think this is part of the administration's push for plain vanilla financial products? I mean, in some ways, isn't this almost as vanilla as it gets?
Well, where I think this is ultimately headed is, I mean, not only are they interested in kind of a plain vanilla a payout that will help them sort of supplement Social Security, but, you know, it also gets to their whole theory of trying to create products that are built around people's natural behavior. So in the same way that they've encouraged, automatic 401ks, automatic IRAs for people to be signed up as soon as they start on the job, what they're eventually hoping to do with these annuities is get employers to enroll, 65-year-old retirees in some form of annuity with some, not all of the money, and do it automatically and let people sort of get used to the regular paycheck. And then after a couple of years, they could opt out. No harm, no foul.
All right. Well, Ron, I don't think you made it quite sexy, but definitely understandable. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks, Tess.
Last week's unemployment numbers offered more proof that it is going to take a long, long time for the job picture to get better in this country. Being out of work can make for extreme financial hardship, but it can also be a time to change things up career-wise. Of course, changes like that come with lots of questions, and here with some answers this week is Kathy Kristoff. Nice to have you back for a chat with our listeners.
Thanks very much. I always enjoy it.
You've been writing about personal finance for, shall we reveal how many years?
Oh, God, it's been so long. We're just going to say over 25 years.
Okay, fair enough. And you're now a CBS Money Watch. But for most of that time, you were with the Los Angeles Times.
Yes.
But you took a buyout at the end of 2008. You walked away.
I did. Yeah, I did. And at the time, you know, everybody thought I was slightly insane because here I was, you know, walking away from a good job. And when the economy went to heck in a handbasket, I thought, yeah, maybe I am insane.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Not great timing on your part.
Yeah.
Huh?
What did I do? But you know what? You live within your means. And if you do that for a long period of time, you have the ability to make choices like that. I had recognized at some point that I had the option of walking away and trying something completely new. And it's been really great, really fun, exciting every day. And
you look very happy.
I am very happy. Thank you.
So you were really, you prepared for that.
Yeah. You know, I didn't know what I was preparing for at the time. And I think this is what I always try and tell my readers, my listeners, is what I think is the greatest luxury in the world is freedom,
yeah,
right? And being able to have options. And so when you don't know what you're saving for, when it's not a house or a car or some particular thing that you want to have, then save for future options. And that's what I did. And so I was able to capitalize on those options. And it's really great.
And you had no credit card debt, we'll assume?
No, I've always hated credit card debt. I probably was, you know, genetically predisposed to be a personal finance columnist. Right? I had a little bit of credit card debt when I was in college, and it drove me completely crazy.
I think that's definitely a qualification.
There you go.
Well, I'm sure that you will have some great advice for John. He's calling from St. Paul, Minnesota. And John, your life change goes way beyond switching jobs, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
What are you doing?
So I was a retail manager for a pharmacy. I didn't really want to do that anymore, and I didn't have any options, so I enlisted in the military.
Wow.
That is a change. That is a life change.
Yeah, it is.
What was your family's reaction? What was that conversation like?
It was, my wife and I had actually been talking about it for a few years. A lot of it's the benefits. I haven't finished college yet, so this is a chance now for me to do that because I have a lot of money now from the GI Bill. Whatever I don't use gets to go to my children.
Mm-hmm.
So that's great, too. You know, the fact that I'd be living on base where they provide your housing, they provide the medical care, it cuts a lot of expenses.
And you don't know where you'll be yet?
No clue. And that really bugs me. But,
so when do you leave for basic training?
5 days.
5 days. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
I assume it's possible that you would be sent over to Iraq or Afghanistan, isn't it?
It is a possibility. My job through the military is a paralegal, though. So I highly doubt that they would send a paralegal right to the front lines or anything. However, there is work I could be doing overseas.
Yeah. But you've definitely decided that the family is going to move with you to whatever base you're stationed at.
Correct. I'm going to be gone until July. My wife and my kids are going to be here until I get back. So my question is what exactly I should do with my home. I talked to a real estate agent in August about my house, and, you know, I realized that I had an underwater mortgage. That was the first time it kind of hit me that my house is worth about $25,000 less than what I could sell it for now. I've owned the home for 5 years, never missed a payment. I really don't know what to do.
Boy, this is a tough situation, Kathy.
Well, you know, it's not as tough as it appears.
No?
It is tough, but you should know two things. First of all, the military has excellent financial counseling. Talk to your commanding officer. But then what you also need to think about is something called a short sale.
Mm-hmm.
The bank agrees to take less than what's owed in order to get you to pay off the loan.
I called the bank and told them my situation just yesterday.
Yeah.
And that's what they told me I should do.
Great.
They did say that it could take quite a long time, though.
Yeah, I think, Kathy, it is taking people a long time to get these short sales done, sometimes up to a year.
And that's the problem, because I'm only going to, you know, my family's going to be here for 6 months. And once I leave, there's no way I can afford to keep paying this mortgage when I'm living on base.
Get it started. And get it started with a realtor who knows about short sales and has done them before. Do the little things that you need to do to make it particularly attractive. That means touching up the paint, planting the front garden, you know, making this kind of stage your house.
But unfortunately, at this point, I guess your wife is going to have to do that because you're not going to
be
there.
Yeah. And with the three kids, that's not going to be very easy for
her. How old are the kids?
5, 4, and 1.
Oh, so they're not going to be able to provide financial assistance at all.
Oh, no.
They're not going to be able to help her do the bills.
maybe help her around the house if she's lucky.
I don't know. My 5-year-old's never did that.
Exactly, yeah.
My 17-year-old doesn't do that.
All right. Kathy, any final thoughts?
Yeah, you know, get the house listed and just immediately start talking to your bank about the fact that you think it's going to be a short sale. You're going to do your best to sell it for as much as you can. But you want to make sure that in 6 months you can indeed walk away.
Mm-hmm.
And you've made an agreement with your bank. You're giving them 6 months that you could just say, you know, I can walk away tomorrow.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, I need to get something back from you that tells me that I'm not being a fool by, you know, doing the right thing here.
Yeah.
And I get it in writing.
Mm-hmm.
So, John, how does your wife feel at this point about kind of having to handle all this while you're gone?
You know, it's overwhelming.
Yeah.
But it's a challenge that she's not afraid of at all. And she's right behind me in every step. So she's ready for it.
Okay.
You're a lucky man.
Yeah, absolutely.
And despite the house, you're a lucky man.
Good luck to you, and thanks again for your service.
Yep, thank you very much.
Well, we would like to hear about your bottom line on our money line, so do give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can head over to marketplace.org and shoot us an email. Look for the Getting Personal link there.
Marketplace Money is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. And here's one more listener question that we wanted to tackle, just because it's fun. Michael Woods wrote to us earlier this week from Billings, Montana, and he was curious about something his family had recently acquired. It was buried in a bundle of old postcards and newspaper clippings they bought for $7.50. It was an old stock certificate, one you will not find on any index or stock listing. So we called him up and asked him to describe it for us.
We have this stock certificate from the American Oil Company, and this was issued in 1916. It's very ornate. It has a big gold corporate seal. Well, my wife is an artist, and she haunts garage sales, and that's where she acquired this. My basic question is, does this certificate have any value?
And for some answers, we turn to David Beach. He is an expert and collector of what's called scripophily, and he appraises everything from cigar box labels to old stock certificates. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Tess. Thank you very much.
Did I say that right? Scripophily?
Yes, scripophily.
Well, we've just heard this description of a certificate from American Oil Company. Let's get right to the point. What do you think it could be worth?
Well, to get to the point, I haven't actually seen it, but I would say that the chances of it having real value are probably one in a million.
Oh, boy.
But it probably does have some collector value, and the collector value is determined mostly by how beautiful the certificate is. In this case, an oil certificate in the early 1900s is probably going to be worth in the $15 if it's not beautiful, and maybe $75 if it's quite beautiful, and maybe up to $150 or so if it's utterly spectacular.
What's the coolest old stock certificate you've ever seen?
Wow, there are some just fantastic ones that are engraved with four or five vignettes in the 1850s and 60s and so forth. Actually, cool to me is a little bit different in that sometimes these certificates are signed by the robber barons. I actually have stock certificates signed by George Eastman of Eastman Kodak. I have J.P. Morgan, John D. Rockefeller.
What do these kinds of things go for?
Well, you can get a John D. Rockefeller for about $3,000 on a Standard Oil certificate. Andrew Carnegie, I know of one certificate that traded for $125,000. Again, these are today's prices. As people discover this, I think a lot of new collectors will come in, and I think the prices can only go up. Where can you buy for $50 something 150 years old that's incredibly beautiful and signed by very important people of the day, a railroad president or something? You know, you just can't do that. So it's just, and it's an amazing hobby.
David Beach is a scripopoly expert in Florida. Does that make you, what, a scripographer, scripopophile?
Oh, a scripopolist. I get excited.
Scripopolist.
Sorry, okay. I'm getting so excited. I love these things.
Well, thanks for chatting about this one for us. You will find David at CigarBoxLabels.com. Thanks so much for helping us out.
Thank you very much.
And we've got pictures of old stocks like Michael's on our website. It's marketplace.org. Auctions can be exciting. All the fast talking, the numbers flying. And when the bidding ends on the items and you win, you get what you bought, right? Well, in the case of bank-owned homes, not always.
So I drove up here, spent the night, paid to get here, and still can't buy the property.
The fine print of foreclosure auctions. That's coming up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We talked earlier in the show about how foreclosure rates just keep going up. One side effect is the booming business of foreclosure auctions. Banks hire auction companies to offload properties that the original owners couldn't pay for, and bidders sign up by the hundreds hoping for a great deal on a house. Sean Cole recently reported on the trend for us, but then he stumbled across an aspect of those auctions that you'll want to know about if you ever attend one. Here's Sean.
So the auction was held in a small ballroom at the Boston Park Plaza Hotel, and this thing happened about midway through that really kind of put a bee in my ball cap. It happened to this kid. I call him a kid. His name is...
Gardner Bowen.
And what do you do?
I'm a real estate investor.
I hope you'll forgive me for saying so. You seem very young to be a real estate investor.
And I am.
how old a guy are you?
23.
I didn't even know what real estate investing was when I was 23. And here Gardner was already a landlord. He was also one of more than 200 bidders at the auction that night, all competing for just 36 properties. But Gardner had his eye on one in particular, a rundown single-family house in Bristol, Rhode Island. He'd seen it, told me it needed $60,000 in repairs, and was in the middle of nowhere, which he liked. Why does that appeal to you?
I rent to college students, and having a house in the middle of nowhere means no neighbors. I'm only going to be bidding on one.
That's the only one.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to have
to... between us.
I will. But after the auction, I'm going to see if you... I hope you get it.
I'll let you know at the end of the auction.
Please do.
All right.
Ladies and gentlemen, here we go. Start the bidding at $19,000. And who came in to buy this one now? $19,000 to buy. 25. Who gave 25?
10 houses went up on the block before Gardner's. And I just have to take a moment to say, these events are truly entertaining. The auctioneer holds court from this high podium, wearing a tuxedo. Two other guys in tuxedos work the floor, egging people to bid more. And every time a bid card goes up, one of the spotter guys lets out a little yelp and cups the air like he's catching a penny.
15, now 60, 70, I bid 60.
Also, the auctioneer doesn't say, "sold," after the bidding, like you'd expect. He says this instead.
Subject confirmation sold the $20,000, subject to the seller's confirmation. Let's go to Bristol.
This was Gardner's house, originally valued at $305,000. The bidding started at just $49,000 and went up really quickly.
Now, Bristol, 49, 50, 60, 60, 70. I'm in 60, buy 10, 70,000 to buy 60, buy 10, 70,000 to buy 80,000 now.
Gardner didn't want to spend more than $60,000, but he hung in. And in the end, with a bid of $87,500, he landed the house.
It is history and subject to seller confirmation your way. Thank you.
Or so he thought. He and his mom were quickly led over to the financing area to the right of the stage, and just as quickly, they came back. Gardner slumped down in his chair like he'd been punched. His mother, Judy, said, they wouldn't sell it to us.
The bank will not accept the bid.
It has a hidden reserve. So I drove up here, spent the night, paid to get here, and still can't buy the property, even though I won the bid.
But what does that mean, a hidden reserve? I mean, like...
It's not an absolute auction.
This is the broker, Dan Sicoccio. He said absolute auction is an industry term.
Absolute means it's a real auction, and that you, whatever you bid on, that's the price.
Which is what we think of when we think of an auction. But there's another kind, a subject-to-lender confirmation auction.
With subject-to-lender confirmation auctions, the bank has a price that must be met.
This is Chris Longley, a spokesman for the National Auctioneers Association.
And so there is a reserve price set.
So when the auctioneer at the end of the bidding says subject-to-lender confirmation, that's what he means.
Absolutely. It is not sold. It is sold subject-to-lender confirmation.
How many foreclosed home auctions are absolute auctions?
I have not come across any absolute foreclosure auctions yet.
Is that okay?
Yeah. You know, our job is to represent our seller. In this case, it is the bank. You know, many of these properties are selling, but some just are not getting a price at the auction block that, you know, meets the needs of the bank.
Now, lots of auctions have reserve prices. eBay has reserve prices. But at this auction, it came as a surprise, at least to Gardner and me. The company that held the event is Real Estate Disposition Corp, or REDC, and it said the reserve condition is clearly stated in the terms and conditions handed out ahead of time. And it is, at the bottom of page 5. I asked a spokesman, Rick Weinberg, why the auctioneer didn't spell it out verbally into the microphone.
Well, we feel our auctioneers and people who run the auctions do that and do a great job.
You feel that, or they do actually? They didn't do that at the Boston auction. That's the only reason I ask.
Well, they are instructed to say many different things, and that is one of them.
To be clear, I recorded almost all of the opening remarks and listened back to all of that tape, didn't hear anything about reserves. Also, if the banks want a certain price for these houses, why not set that price as the opening bid? Some of these opening bids were as low as $500, which seems to say, look, you can maybe get a house for that much.
No, that's never said. That's never said, and you'll never find it anywhere.
It's kind of implied, though. I mean, you know, if I'm looking at a sheet and it says, like, opening bid $1,000, I'm like, $1,000? Right. Oh, my God, even if it goes up to $40,000, that's still $40,000 for a house.
But then someone has to do their homework and realize it's not an absolute auction.
How would they know to do that kind of work?
Well, they have to do their homework. They have to do their due diligence.
I talked to the bank that owned the house Gardner bid on. They didn't want to go on the record, but they said when you start the bidding low, there's a better chance it'll end up way above the reserve. That's just how auctions work, they said.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, that concludes our sale tonight. I want to remind you that...
After the auction, Gardner and his broker and his mom complained to the people in charge. It started as a gentle chat and quickly escalated into what looked like a fairly heated little scuffle. The broker asked me not to record that part. And in the end, to its credit, REDC agreed to present Gardner's offer to the bank.
And in this particular case, you know, the young man actually was willing to discuss some other information about the property.
This is the vice president of auctions for the company, Trent Ferris.
And while we don't think that the seller is going to accept it because it was a subject to...
You don't think the bank will come
down? I don't know. That's why we're going to go ahead and be willing to give him the opportunity on it.
I should point out that disputes like this are not common. They do happen. And one analyst told me they used to happen a lot more before banks got more realistic about housing prices. Also, REDC only gets paid if the house sells. It makes its money from a 5% buyer's premium.
It's in their best interest to help us out and figure out a way to get the information to the bank.
I caught up with Gardner again as he and his mom were finally filling out forms.
And that's kind of what they explained to us after they found out I was kind of upset with the way that the system works.
So you told them you were upset?
Oh, yeah. Just like I told you.
And how did they react when you told them you're upset?
I'm signing papers now.
And a little more than a month later, the deal finally went through, and Gardner was the proud owner of a rundown house in the middle of nowhere that needed $60,000 worth of work. In Boston, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace Money.
Okay, let's explore more of your life with dollar signs. Personal finance columnist Kathy Kristoff is with me to take your calls. And let's go to Pam, who's with us from Pacifica, California. That's in the Bay Area, right, Pam?
Yeah, it's about, I don't know, 5 miles away from San Francisco, just south along the coast.
Oh, lovely. Well, so you wrote us about change as well. Are you joining the Army?
Oh, no, definitely not joining the Army. definitely not. My husband and I live together in Southern California in Orange County, where we have a beautiful home. And a couple of years ago, a job in Northern California came up, and I jumped at the opportunity. We thought at first, hey, we'll both move to Northern California. Everything will work out great.
Uh-huh.
The housing market was way outrageous in San Francisco, as I'm sure everyone who lives here can tell you.
Right.
And it was too expensive to sell our house in Orange County and buy a house in San Francisco. And so he lives at the house in Orange County, and I am renting a place in San Francisco.
Oh, my goodness. So I think we can still then call you bi-coastal because you're on different parts of the coast.
Okay.
Wow. So this is not something that you were counting on happening, I assume.
Oh, no, definitely not.
You said earlier that you weren't going to sell your house in Orange County because it was too expensive then to buy in San Francisco. But why not sell in Orange County and continue to rent in San Francisco?
Mostly his job also. He's very stable in his job, and we're a little bit afraid for him to find a new job in Northern California.
Well, Kathy, it sounds like somebody's got to give.
You've got a situation where you got to start making some choices, unless you're fine with both living in different cities. And
do you like your husband?
Oh, I love him very much. We've been together now like 16 years. So
yeah, this is a lot of time to spend apart. Can you make it work if one of you drops the job?
What about buying a second home? What if we count San Francisco and buy up here and buy down there? I mean, what I'm paying for rent, $1,700, I don't know how much more markedly it would be to count that as a mortgage. And as a second home, we would get more tax benefits.
I think you're limited on that.
And owning a home is, I mean, it's not just the mortgage that you're talking about paying. Owning a home is far more expensive than just the monthly nut.
Yeah. You could buy about a $200,000 home for what you're paying in rent.
And good luck, frankly, finding a two-bedroom, one-bath house for $200,000 in the Bay Area?
It's tough. That second home is more than likely going to be a greater burden. And so what you really need to think about is, do you want to find a roommate? Or do you want to start thinking about, you know, like finding a way to transfer your job or transfer his job so that you can actually be in the same city at the same time?
It's becoming the law of diminishing returns, definitely.
Yeah,
absolutely. You know, these things always sound like a great idea, and it's, you know, it's exciting and there's something new. Stark cold reality starts to set in and you go, wow, this not only is not as good as I thought economically, it's not as good personally.
Exactly.
You got to keep in mind that money is a tool to make your life more pleasant and comfortable. This job away from home is not making your life more pleasant and comfortable. Think about what you can do in order to get in the same city or to cut your expenses.
Can I deduct anything, like if I fly down to see him or when he comes up here? Can we deduct any of that?
Not unless it's for business.
Yeah, this is the challenge with the tax code. And the IRS decides to audit you later and they say, not a business expense. And they're not only going to charge you the money that you didn't pay in tax, they're going to charge you penalties and interest. It's just not worth cheating.
Yeah, I guess that $100 round trip air flight on Virgin is looking really much better than going to prison.
Yeah, there's that. They don't usually throw you in prison for $100, you know, cheating. But, you know, there's always that possibility. I can see where your mind is going, and you're very imaginative. Maybe screenwriting is for you.
Well, so I do have to ask you, Pam, any plans for Valentine's Day? Any quality time on the horizon there?
Oh, yeah. We have already allotted a four-day weekend, taking the Friday and the Monday. So,
All right.
We have that part straightened out. I guess the lesson here is we could have, should have done the math a little better before we jumped right in. But, boy, there's some times when the job market just calls, and
yeah.
I felt like if I don't take this, there may not be anything else. But
well, thanks so much for the call, Pam.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much, Tess.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, Kathy, I think that qualifies as quality time with us, don't you?
Absolutely.
Would you ever do anything like that?
No. But, you know, I'm divorced. So, you know, who am I to ask about relationships?
All right. Well, moving on. If you would like to be our Valentine, or at least spend a little time on the phone with us, leave us a love note at marketplace.org or call us up at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Kathy, it's been great to have you on the show. I'm sorry that you have to sprint off.
Well, there's that problem with working, you know, day in, day out. They expect you to do something.
Well, I'm glad you don't consider this work.
No, not at all. This is fun.
All right. And remember to always check with your financial professional before you make any big money decisions.
Marketplace Money is supported by Nightly Business Report on PBS, presenting Your Mind and Your Money, a series looking at psychological factors that can lead investors to make mistakes, Mondays on Nightly Business Report on PBS stations. And by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to strengthen America by empowering more young people to achieve educational success beyond high school.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
As we examine the causes of the economic downfall, denial, pie-in-the-sky idealism, greed, it might be a good time to look at how these mistakes apply to our love lives.
Just in time for Valentine's Day, commentator Lori Gottlieb looks at how she got herself into a romantic recession.
Back in my 20s, there seemed to be a huge supply of single men out there. Men my age, divorced men twice my age, widowers three times my age. I mean, who doesn't want to date a 25-year-old? And with all the supply of interested men, I thought, why should I date the guy in the next cubicle at work? Why not hold out for my version of George Clooney? Then, as I entered my 30s, the supply and demand curve shifted. My value went down, while the value of guys my age went up. But I didn't adjust. I didn't realize that setting my price point too high would create a dating bubble that, like the housing market, was bound to pop. There was no Fed chairman overseeing romance to come in and say, "You've got to tighten up your credit here, you're inflating your value, and besides, Prince Charming doesn't exist." Well, okay, my mother said that, but I didn't listen. Which is exactly how I ended up in a romantic recession. Left to my own unregulated devices, I ignored the costs of pursuing some unrealistic romantic payday. First, there were the sunk costs, all the time, money, and emotional reserves invested in a series of super exciting guys with more style than substance. I'd share the details of my childhood, spend weeks making cheesy mixtapes, and live through the holidays with his parents, only to realize these guys were, well, overrated. They had the charm, but they lacked the longevity. Then there were the opportunity costs. The price I paid for not being available to meet more appropriate men because I stayed too long with the cool musician who never called when he said he would. Other times I sold too early. I broke up with guys who turned out to be fabulous husbands to other women, but they hadn't reached their peak market value when I was dating them. Back then, stability was as sexy as shares of IBM. And like every sucker in an economic boom time, I invested heavily in risky, volatile stocks, even though those rarely turn out to be good long-term investments. Of course, all the signs indicated that things weren't going well, but I chose to look the other way. Nearing 40 and still single, I didn't want to admit that I was on the verge of romantic collapse. In reality, I completely lost sight of what actually would have made me happy. I should have slowly built up equity with one really good, but imperfect partner over the years. I was just like those folks at Goldman Sachs who got carried away with dreams of bigger dollar signs and didn't appreciate what they had until it was too late. So all I'm saying is, invest responsibly in your love life, because you won't get a $700 billion bailout to compensate for your dopey mistakes. You'll just get another night of eating takeout in front of the TiVo with your cats. And that's no way to spend Valentine's Day, is it?
Lori Gottlieb's new book is Marry Him, The Case for Settling for Mr. Goodenough. Your thoughts? Go to marketplace.org and click on contact. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, the airport experience now includes baggage fees, frisking, and interminable waits to board the plane. On top of it all, the sales pitch for a mileage award credit card.
They're taking advantage of the fact that you're in a rush, that you're not thinking, that you've got other things to do, to talk you into stuff that you wouldn't normally buy.
That and more on the new credit card regulations that are set to take effect. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Trobe. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering strategies for investors seeking both returns and lower volatility. On the web at putnam.com/absolute return.
American Public Media.